Hi everyone, and welcome to the Bold Beautiful Borderline podcast. My name is Lori, and today I'm joined by Heather, who is a dietitian practice leader from a local health authority. And actually, Heather took the same master's program that I did a year after. So maybe I'll just like randomly start saying how I got connected with you, because it's kind of a weird situation, and then I'll pass you to introduce yourself. So I'm really interested in the concept of weight stigma in healthcare and mental health care, all sorts of health, because many of us have experienced weight stigma. If you're one of our Patreon members, you'll know that I just had a psychiatrist tell me that like I actually don't have mental health issues. I'm just fat. So like literally like a month ago. So it's like not a surprise that I'm interested in weight stigma, because it's very, very much prevalent every day. And so I was at a conference and talking to somebody who was in Heather's class in the same master's program. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm interested in weight stigma as a concept. And they were like, you have to talk to Heather, because she like super advocated for the fact that like there was weight stigma as part of this, the program, like the master's program. And like, they've now apparently changed this particular assignment that was like about bariatric surgery that you kind of stood up for. So super glad we're connected. Super glad we're going to talk about this, and you're going to talk about your research. And yeah, I'll pass to you to just kind of introduce yourself and anything you want to share about.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, Lori, for having me on the podcast. And yes, I'm also so stoked that they changed the bariatric surgery study that was in that program, in the master's program that we both did. Yeah, I guess probably a good place to start is just where I got interested about weight stigma, which was actually from a conversation with one of my friends, where she called me out on my weight stigma. And it was one of those things where she was kind of like, you're a dietitian, you should know about this. Why don't you know about this? And it really took me aback. I felt like pretty guilty, which is like such a normal reaction to having your bias called out. And from there, I kind of like rethought everything that I was doing and realized how much weight stigma was pervading my practice and how much weight stigma pervaded so many things within healthcare and so many of the recommendations we have in healthcare. And that kind of started me down this journey of, this is not okay. And the more that I learned, the more that I was like, this is not okay.
I so appreciate the honesty there around like, yeah, it's because I didn't know. And like, I would argue most of us don't know. Like I try to be very aware of weight stigma, but I hold so much weight stigma about myself, about my partner, about society, about my friends. Like, as much as I'm aware of it, it doesn't mean that I don't have it, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's kind of the whole thing with bias, is it's these things that happen that we have been taught time and time again. And it's like totally invisible to the people who have privilege in that situation, and very, very visible to those who don't.
Do you want to maybe just explain like really briefly what weight stigma means, just for people who may be unfamiliar with that term?
Yeah, totally. Oftentimes when I'm talking about weight stigma, I kind of have to back up a little bit, because there's this kind of belief that we should all be a certain shape or a certain size, and that being a certain shape or a certain size is healthy, quote unquote. And these assumptions are kind of like some of the bedrock of weight stigma within our society. And kind of the down low is that no, people don't have to be a certain size to be healthy. Also, there's just so much pressure to be healthy, period, which is a whole other kettle of fish when it comes to like healthism and stuff like that. But we'll leave that for another talk.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to talk about that another time too.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's these stereotypes and beliefs that surround this idea that we can lose weight and that we should lose weight and that we should be a certain size in order to be quote unquote healthy, aka oftentimes it comes down to also attractive or likable or things like that. And if you don't try hard enough, or if you just did try hard enough, then you could change your body to be whatever shape that you wanted, which creates this stigma of if we aren't that certain shape that like the media portrays or that we are told by the healthcare system, which is awful, that it's our fault, that it's because we're lazy, it's because we didn't try hard enough, it's because we ate too much of the wrong thing. And it causes so much guilt and shame and also just so many things within society that just are so harmful to people. For example, like even just the assumption that like chairs within a doctor's office should just fit the quote unquote normal sized person, even though that normal sized person, quote unquote, it is like this ideal thin person. It doesn't take into account that like this is just like a variety of shapes and sizes, and maybe we should have chairs that fit those shapes and sizes so that people don't feel bad coming in.
And like, isn't the average American, or I don't know about Canadian, but American woman like a size 16 to 18 or something? And like, that's considered like definitely plus size when you consider like where you can actually buy clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, why are we having chairs that specifically like have the handles too close together so that they dig into you, or they just don't fit, period. Yeah, exactly. So if you're really looking at what is normal, quote unquote, like it's not this thin ideal. And yeah, those types of things just show up everywhere within our society and within our healthcare system. And that all negatively affects people's mental health, their physical health, which I'm sure I'll get into later. These ideals actually cause more harm than good. So did I answer your question about weight stigma?
I think so. Yeah. Like like any stigma that people with borderline that listen to this podcast know all about stigma, because we're stigmatized all day, every day in the healthcare system and society. But I mean, the other way that it's been described by Aubrey Gordon, who's like an author that I really like and a podcaster with Maintenance Phase, mm-hmm. she talks about, I think she calls it anti-fat bias instead of weight stigma, but similar idea, right? You're fat, therefore you are a bad person, or that's why you're unhealthy. And I mean, like people avoid healthcare all the time because they've just been told, well, if you were less lazy, you wouldn't have these health problems. And it's like, no, but there's people who have health problems that like are big, small, medium, whatever. And like, it's actually a lot of the time completely unrelated to what actual weight they have.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. There are so many places that comes up. And yeah, the difference between the terms bias and stigma, because I had to wrap my head around this. Like the way that I figured to wrap my head around it is bias is the experience of the oppressor. And stigma is the experience of the person who's been stigmatized.
Oh, interesting. I've never heard it phrased like that, but that makes sense.
Yeah. So whether it's anti-fat bias and we're focusing on the oppressor's experience, or whether it's weight stigma and we're focusing on the experience of the person who's like experiencing the oppression, period. Yeah. But either way, basically often gets used interchangeably.
Well, I don't want to jump too far ahead. Maybe I'll leave you to what you want to say next, and then I'll come to my question later.
No, go for it. What was your question?
How much of that was taught to you in school when you were becoming a dietitian around this is what healthy means?
Yeah, definitely. So when I went to school, which wasn't that long ago, like a decade ago, we briefly talked about weight stigma, and it wasn't even called weight stigma. It was just, oh, FYI, in one course that was completely like unrelated to what was being taught, FYI, there are all of these different things that impact weight. And that was like basically all we got. And then in another course, they mentioned, oh, by the way, like your weight doesn't like to change very much or something like that. It was like very offhanded. Now they definitely have a lot more information about it within courses, but even dietitians coming out are still like, now what do I do about this? Because even if you know about weight stigma, then to come into this very weight stigmatized health authority, how do you practice in that? What do you do when everybody around you is also weight stigmatized in a very blatant, harmful way?
And it's not just the health system either. It's like every day you look around and there's weight stigma and you're probably perpetrating what weight stigma or experiencing it or both, like all the time. Yeah. So even if it's like taught different in school, like the health at every size movement or whatever.
It's
not as easy as just being like, it's fine then. Like, it goes beyond that. I mean, this is like such a side note, but I feel like we're probably the same age-ish. And I don't know if you don't have social media. There's all of these things on social media right now around like our generation when we were growing up and like what was considered fat. And there's all of these images that like I can guarantee you saw when you were like whatever. I can't remember how old we were, probably like 15 or something. And it's like Jessica Simpson was wearing these like jeans and everybody called her fat. And you look at her now and you're like, I thought that was fat. That's more. First of all, it shouldn't matter. But that woman was probably a size like 6. And it's like the entire media was like, she's fat. She let herself go. Ew, how gross is she? And it's like, oh my God, that's just such a scary thing to think that like it's so ingrained in us because we were children and being fed this narrative all the time.
And that's just media. That's not even like when you get into kids coming into doctor's offices and being told to lose weight or like parents being shamed about their child being a certain size. And oh my goodness. Yeah.
Actually, sorry, another random anecdote here. My husband is a bigger person too and has been his entire life, like me. And both of our siblings are thin. And his mom would get like, his teachers would come up to her and be like, hey, like you need to make sure that Aaron is like exercising and whatever. And she was like, I bike to school with Aaron every single day. His brother gets dropped off. Aaron eats better than his brother, like all of these things. And it was like, just because his body looks different does not mean that he's not healthy. And he was like 7 or whatever when that was happening, if not younger. It's like, it's so ingrained.
Yeah. Yeah. And then how that ends up playing out afterwards, if we have all of these traumas and all of these food rules that just get built in. And all of this extra shame about our body and what we're eating and not being good enough and all that kind of stuff that ends up coming out of
that. Yeah, you all go to Weight Watchers with your mom at like 16 or whatever. Like, it's just such a classic, such a classic story, you know?
And it's like, even just like the efficacy of weight loss is one of those things that it's always touted as like, weight loss is such an evidence-based therapy. And yet when you actually look at the evidence around whether or not weight loss actually works, it doesn't. It's kind of like it's short-term might work, but long-term doesn't for the vast majority of people is like the quick version of that. But like, they did a study in the UK that reviewed over 170,000 medical records over a 10-year period to analyze the probability of actually achieving weight loss within a year. And to achieve the quote-unquote BMI that was appropriate was like 1 in 124 to 1 in 1,290 people. Within 1 year.
And that was within 1 year?
So
not even a 10-year span of them gaining it back.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's you stole the words right out of my mouth, Lori. Of like, 1 year is the most likely portion where we're going to see the weight loss is that 6 to 12 month period. And then after that, within the 2 to 5 years, that's where we see way more of that weight regain. Even just losing 5% of your body weight within a year was still 1 in 5 to 1 in 12, depending on like your starting BMI or your starting sex of the person. So, yeah.
And it, I mean, BMI is also just like a bullshit metric regardless. So
100%.
Yeah. So it's like all of these studies look at BMI and then they're like, but BMI doesn't actually mean anything. Yeah. And you're like, so why are we only using BMI as a like metric
here? Because it's easy.
Yeah. Totally. But there is one, somebody showed me, I want to say it was out of Alberta. Do you know the thing I'm talking about? It's like a weight, it's like an alternative to the BMI, and it's a Canadian thing. And it's really cool because I'll try and find it while we're talking, but it talks about like your more holistic view of what your weight might look like. So, you know, obviously we can talk about like, should you even measure like weight at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. But like that, you know, that aside, it seemed like a much better option than just BMI alone, because it included things like, does it cause you stress? Do you feel distressed after you eat certain things or whatever? And it was just like a much more holistic view. I'll try and find it.
But yeah, it's like we have all of these guidelines for healthcare that just don't make sense. Like, for example, the BMI itself, which was before it was called the BMI, was originally done by research from, every time I hear his name, I'm not sure who says it right. It's Adolphe Quetelet, I think is how it's said, something like that. And then later on was used for eugenics research, aka the study of finding the perfect well-off white man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In their like 40s or whatever. Like it was very specific. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, and then it's like, okay, so we're going to take this, this thing that was meant for populations of people, first of all, and we're going to apply it to individuals of all different like races, genders, every possible thing.
Socioeconomic statuses, like.
Exactly. Yeah.
What food do you have access to? Where do you live? Like, yeah, all of these things.
Yeah.
First of all, the thing that I was looking at is called the Edmonton Obesity Staging System. And it's worth looking at. I thought it was kind of cool. But when this psychiatrist the other day basically said like, oh, if you should just get more motivation and lose weight and then you wouldn't be mentally ill, which is quite funny. she had asked me how much I weighed and I told her because it was a phone visit. And I was like, oh, but like, I'm 5'10". She's like, it doesn't matter. And I was like, well, obviously BMI is dumb, but like, if I was 4'2", my weight would be quite different than if I was 5'10". It was just like, the stigma is so prevalent that it's like, I've also been 100 pounds less than I am now and was still mentally ill. So like, I don't think that's correlated at all. If anything, I was more mentally ill because I wasn't eating properly and I was exercising 24 hours a day. So dumb.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like that's something that's so important to point out, that like, yes, weight stigma itself does contribute to making your mental health worse, and like you're way more likely to have anxiety or depression if you are experiencing lots of weight stigma. But that losing weight doesn't fix everything, which is like so often what they say of, oh, you can reduce the stigma by just losing weight. And it's like, well,
yeah,
as we just discussed, effectiveness not really working. Also, when you look at research that looks at weight regain, up to 95% of people will regain within 5 years.
And then some, right?
Exactly. And then 2/3 to 78%, depending on what study you're looking at, will regain more than they lost within those 5 years. And that's even if you lose only 5% of your body weight. So,
and it shouldn't be up to the individual to just be what we want you to be,
exactly,
as opposed to the society and the system changing their opinion of people for no reason.
100%, yeah. 100% of it's just like, we are going to dump all of this on the individual. We're going to say that it's evidence-based, but it's not evidence-based. In fact,
you can cherry pick your evidence. That's the thing.
100%.
You can say evidence-based, exactly, for basically anything. And it's because you're just ignoring the studies that don't show what you want them to show.
Yeah. And that's like one of the things that just comes up so often in weight loss research, is they don't even look oftentimes at weight stigma or delayed access to care, which you mentioned before, which is a really big one, or weight cycling. So when you try to lose weight, you regain weight, and then you try to lose weight, and you regain weight, which is actually really horrible. A lot of the things that are typically suspected to be because of weight are related to those three things, which are all related to like weight stigma and us telling people to be different than what they are, as if that was possible.
And I would assume that it also, some of these like health related concerns are probably also side effects of medications that people are on because they have to fit into a box, whether it be a mental health box or a obesity box or whatever box, that like is making them take drugs that make pharmaceutical companies bajillions of dollars. There's obviously a clear example these days. Everybody knows about it. We won't get into the details because a lot of our people have eating disorders, and it's just not, it's a slippery slope I don't want to get into at this time, but it's like the pharmaceutical companies benefit from when you desperately try and lose weight all the time. And then you have side effects from all of these things that you're doing to try and lose weight. And then you take extra drugs to try and counteract the side effects. Like, people benefit from the diet industry all the time, hugely.
Yeah, I think last I checked was like 2018 or something like that. And it was like $1.8 billion industry. But yeah, exactly. People benefit. Like, it's unfortunate, but part of the bedrock of weight stigma is capitalism.
Totally.
Yeah. Capitalism, racism, like any box that you want to be stuck in. Sexism, yeah. Exactly. Any box you want to be stuck in, like, probably also contributes to weight stigma.
Yeah, there's so many intersectionalities going on when it comes to weight, like, and healthcare access in general, right? Like, this is just yet another way that people are discriminated against in the healthcare system.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you did research on this topic specifically for your master's. What do you want to tell us about that in general?
Sure. Yeah. So the research that I did was specifically on dietitian views of how to support patients, or how to support reducing weight stigma, period, within the system, within my health authority. And so I talked to a number of dietitians who are activists to reduce weight stigma within our health authority, and just like asked them a bunch of questions about like how do you go about having those conversations? Like, what are the barriers that you see in our health system? What are the things that might actually help enablers to improve the health system in order for us to be actually able to have these conversations and to help reduce on a grassroots level? Because sometimes you need grassroots in order to push from ministry and show that there is need. So that was the big piece of what came out of my research was a bunch of lists of all the barriers and enablers to reducing weight stigma. Both
I love lists.
Yeah.
Lists are my favorite way of reading.
Yeah. of like all the barriers to actually reducing within the system, period, but also within like dietitian services, period. Because we're like, we have to start small. This is something that we should, as an entire group, know about and all be pushing in the same direction. So we need to know what are the things that we can do to help the entire group of dietitians in our health authority push to reduce weight stigma, which of course is first like learning about weight stigma, but then also learning about how to talk about weight stigma, which is the second piece of my research, is actually having kind of like a step-by-step of, okay, like, how do you go about recognizing weight stigma? How do you go about dealing with it? Like, how do you have that conversation with doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, like family? Mostly I stuck in my research around other health professionals, but I think it is really important for dietitians to be having those conversations also with patients too.
Of course. Yeah. And their families, because families impact what you eat so much, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Speaking from like just recently with the holidays.
Yeah. We're recording this over Christmas. So yeah, we all, culturally and holiday and all that stuff impacts it for sure. And also like there's so many people in families. Like, I mean, I think most of us have at least like half of our family members are yo-yo dieters and are, you know, mm-hmm. sitting at a dinner table talking about their current diet and like not understanding how incredibly triggering that can be. But also like, it's just contributing to the weight stigma of like, oh, well, I don't eat carbs. And then as you're like eating bread and you're like, well, what do you feel about me if you're talking about how you don't eat carbs? You know what I mean? Like it's just forever. So out of curiosity, so the talking to the health, the other health providers, like super important. As a dietitian team, did your people that you were interviewing feel like they were kind of like the person that was constantly knocking on their door, the other health providers' doors and being like, hey, you're being an asshole, or like, hey, like, you know, just because they're overweight doesn't mean that they eat badly or don't exercise. Like, did they feel like kind of the bad guy in that situation?
Definitely there's like a lot of burnout related to always being the person who's being like, no, like you can't do this. Like, that's not okay. Like, you need to learn about weight stigma and why this is not okay. And like, no, I'm not going to provide like weight loss, suggestions, or really you probably shouldn't be on those medications. But that person, like, like there's absolutely no indication and many indications for harm. And I think that basically every dietitian I talked to was kind of like, on one hand, they feel awful for the patients who are experiencing the direct harm, and they also feel harm as well on the other hand, because they're doing their best to protect these patients. And people, because it can be in any setting, whether it's residential, like a resident in long-term care, or like a client in outpatients or whatever. But it's like so harmful to see that over and over and over again of the same person, even though you've talked to them a million times, still doing the same thing over and over. And kind of feeling helpless, I guess. There's a lot of feeling helpless and like we're not making progress, which is why we need to band together, which is the whole part of like why I did my research, was to figure out some ideas on like how we can come together and actually start to make more progress.
Yeah, that's so important. And like to hear from the people who are experiencing it, like there's nobody else's opinion matters as much as them and the patients, right? Can you provide some examples of like, it sounds like it's referrals a lot of the time that you're getting, like of how you've seen patients be harmed by the weight stigma of their providers and how you've tried to intervene?
Oh yeah, for sure. So for example, like we'll get referrals for weight loss because their wheelchair is going to be too small if they keep gaining weight. And it's like, no, that you just need to get them a new wheelchair. Like, you need to get them a wheelchair that fits, that's access to care, or suggesting weight loss so that they can fit into like a bed that they're going to in long-term care, rather than just waiting for a bed that's the right size. Or like referral for weight loss because they just think they're too big, or because, you know, they were somebody who was looking at their medications and one of their medications was dosed on weight and they should lose weight because, you know, well, that's too big, quote unquote, is one of the like big things that comes up over and over again, is just this idea of, oh, well, this is also important. Like, oh, you have to lose weight because of XYZ. And oftentimes there's no asking the patient or the person like, do you even want this referral for intentional weight loss? Or there's the discussion and there's no consent to having the discussion to begin with. It's just like straight up, I'm going to tell you to lose weight. Like sometimes there's like the strangest things that people have been told. I had one client who was told to drink broth and have a multivitamin daily for 2 weeks. And that was the appropriate thing to do. And I was
that's all they were supposed to do? Like eat?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. And I was like, that's off. Like, no, like you would give yourself something called refeeding syndrome, which is basically very, very harmful and actually puts you at risk for like passing away. So like, no.
There's a good documentary about that on Netflix. Have you watched it? I think it's called White Savior. I think it's Netflix. Should watch it.
Yeah.
You would love it. It's a girl who goes to Africa and accidentally like kills all of these kids because she's trying to refeed them. And she's not a healthcare provider, but she just like thinks that she can save all of these kids in Africa. It's horrifying, but it's like, you would love it probably because it's all about that and how people are just stupid when it comes to food. They're like, it's just food. And you're like, no. Like you need to actually do it properly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Of it's just like some very harmful recommendations with absolutely no thought as to how this is going to harm the patient. No consent on the patient's part. Like a lot of guilt tripping often of like, well, you should just stop eating junk food or you should just stop eating whatever. And it's like, well, actually, you didn't ask me at all what I was eating, period.
Totally. Yes. Totally. Oh man. I know that so many people that listen to this have had that too, where they're like, well, like you should really eat vegetables or like you should really exercise. And it's like, I exercise 5 days a week and I eat like 3 meals a day that are balanced. So like, I'm not saying I do that all the time, but like, you know, the assumption that like you don't exercise, you don't take care of yourself. It's unreal. Cause they never ask, hey, what does your workout look like? Or what does your food look like? It's just like assumed like, oh, well, you must just only eat McFlurries. Like, well, no, this is just what I look like. And also like, I can also be happy with what I look like.
Exactly. And also I'm still allowed to eat McFlurries. I'm still allowed to eat junk food, no matter what 100%. I look like.
Yeah. But like, I also eat vegetables. You know what I mean? Like, I just like,
yeah. Like, you didn't even ask if I eat vegetables. You just assumed that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And like those examples make me so sad. I mean, I'm sure you could do 18 hours of recording about examples that make us sad, but those examples make me extra sad for some reason because they're stupid physical reasons that it's literally to make the provider's life easier, right? It's to get them into the long-term care bed so that they don't have to see them as much, or it's to get them the new wheelchair without having to do additional paperwork about why they need a new wheelchair for their insurance, or they're going to stop taking these medications so that I can, or take a more reasonable dose of these medications so I don't have to do some sort of override because it's more than the normal dose, or like whatever. It's all just trying to make the provider more comfortable as opposed to what patient-centered care should be, which is focusing on what the individual wants for themselves and what makes them healthy based on their own definition, right?
It's this idea that it's just easier for them to change their body. As if it's easy to change your body size.
And as if like anybody that's overweight has not spent their entire existence trying to change their body size.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I told you about the carnivore diet lady on the cruise where she was like, I was reading a book about fats, anti-fat bias. Yeah. And then she was like, oh, honey, forget the book. You should just try the carnivore diet. And it's like, and then she was like, oh, have you heard of it? And it's like, yes, I've heard of every diet, ma'am. Like, I've been overweight for 30 years. Like, I'm fully aware of every diet that you can name. And I've probably tried like 80% of them. They don't work. This is just what I look like. And here I am trying to accept it.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. People just have like no shame or like no like self-awareness, I guess, that like some people's bodies just look different.
It's like this idea that we have in our society that to be a quote unquote good person, you have to be like the thin ideal. And if you aren't, then another thin person will come up to you and tell you how to do it. as if they know better than you, and as if that is their civic duty to you to like tell you how to be a different size, as if they've got it all figured out because they genetically were predisposed to being that size.
Totally. So I know one of the questions that, or debates, I guess, that I have often with my inside my own head with other people, whatever, is we talk about like the health at every size. I can't remember what your opinion is on that movement, but long story short, that's kind of self-explanatory what it stands for. But there are times where like your weight does impact your quality of life, probably because society screws with us and makes that the case. But like, what's the balance between like, well, I used to run all the time, and now when I run, my knees hurt for 2 days. So yes, I can go for walks or I can go swimming, but like, you know, there are times where like different weights can impact physical and social things more than not. It's a terribly worded sentence.
It kind of comes down to the question of, is there a size at which it's not okay, at which you are suddenly not okay? Like, where's the line of which you are no longer okay? And what I come back with that is, the quick answer, I don't think there is a size that it's not okay to be. And my kind of reasoning behind that is, first of all, like, we have no way to lose weight sustainably. Like, even if you did do bariatric surgery, oftentimes many people have weight regain.
And horrible side effects. Like,
exactly.
Oh, yeah, I can't. I mean, I qualify for it if I wanted it, but I don't want to go down that road for that reason.
That's exactly a horrible side effects that oftentimes you're not told about before the surgery. Like, hey, you might only be able to fit a certain amount of food into your stomach, and if you eat more than that, you're gonna vomit it up. Not intentionally, that's just what's gonna happen. Or it's gonna move through your system too fast and you're gonna have diarrhea, or like, just very uncomfortable.
And like, for the rest of your life. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And some people get to the place where that feels like the only thing that they can possibly do to feel better in their body, because they've experienced absolutely so much weight stigma. And like, I really feel for those people. And I really hope that people who are kind of on the edge of that place find somebody to talk to, ideally a professional, but also even just like a podcast, like Body Grievers is a great podcast, which is by Body Image for Brie. And she also does like a whole bunch of like group sessions to help people with around body image and like grieving the fact that you're no longer going to be striving for that thin body that you wanted, and like talking about how letting go of that is so painful, of that idea that maybe finally I'll get to be like accepted in society.
And even when you get to a certain size, you're still gonna feel like you're overweight and fat and what. I mean, I have this photo of me from like 10 years ago where I was literally 100 pounds less than I am now. I basically have abs, and I remember that day going, oh my God, I think I'm too fat to wear this outfit. And it's like, I look back on it now and I'm like, oh my God, you're in like that. What do you mean? That's impossible. But it just never ends. You can be whatever weight you want. It's always going to be the same thing. I just want to touch on the bariatric thing just for one more second. Two things. One, like I say, I wouldn't do that because of the side effects. I don't judge anybody that does, because like Heather said, like there's so much societal pressure to lose weight. And medical pressure to lose weight. Mm-hmm. Doctors like ask about that all the time.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that like, it's totally within your right. And I know that like my husband did this the other day. He had a new doctor that he went to and he was doing his like intake. And he said immediately, like, just so you know, I'm never going to get bariatric surgery. Please don't ask me about it. I don't want to talk about it. And I was like, good for you, dude. And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to have that conversation. I don't want to entertain it. So I'm just going to tell them right away. And like, you have every right to reject medical advice that you're getting from a provider. that's you decide what happens to you, and don't be afraid to say it. And if they keep pushing it, then like message me and I'll help you complain about them to their college, because it's not okay. Like if you say, I don't want to talk about my weight, and they force you to talk about your weight, then like that's them being a bad doctor or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's so important, because oftentimes we don't think that we can do that. We don't think that we can push back and say, no, I don't want to get weighed. And that's like one of the things that came up within my study of like a barrier is all of these places where it's you automatically get weighed. And not only do you automatically get weighed, it's oftentimes in the hallway where everybody else can see you and see the number. And like, that's also not okay. But being able to say, actually, no, like, I don't want to talk about my weight unless it's related to like congestive heart failure because I have fluid shifts, or because like I need to get it done for a certain medication or like something like that. But I have a letter that I give out to my clients where it's like a pre-written letter by me that literally has all the stuff in it of like, no way, do not weigh. Because that's such a hard thing, and so often that you will be pressured, which is absolutely ridiculous, because in so many other settings, when we think about like consent, like pressuring somebody to consent is not okay. Like,
no, that's not consent.
Yeah. I always love the like, I don't know if you've seen it, the little thing of the consent around having tea of like,
yes, yes. I haven't seen it in so long. I feel like that came out when we were in like early university, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a good example though, of like, you can't just like make somebody consent. It's not a thing. If like you think about like, thank God we're all pretty aware of sexual assault and consent in that space, like I'm very, very thankful for that. But like, there's so many things that people don't understand that they do have to consent to in terms of healthcare. I love that idea of a letter though. That's brilliant.
It's helpful oftentimes, because like in that moment of when you're being told to like, oh, can you step on the scale? And it's like, there was no question of, do you want to, can you, is this okay with you? Like, what am I going to use this number for? Like anything like that. Oftentimes it's not even the doctor who's doing it, or it's like right before your appointment and just like throws everything off.
Totally. And then you forget what you're going to say because you are stressed about the fact you were weighed and like, you don't know why you were. Yeah. It's. And like a lot of the time they're just weighing you for the sake of weighing you.
Exactly.
Because that's what they were taught to do. If you can justify to me like, hey, I need to weigh you because this medication that you're on is very specific to how much you weigh XYZ. Fine. I will be weighed in that circumstance, but I've never been provided an explanation for something like that. And like, they should be providing you explanations for everything that they're doing. That's part of like trauma-informed care too.
Yeah, definitely. And also, if you don't want to see the number on the scale, and they have to get a weight for like congestive heart failure or for medication or whatever, like you can back onto the scale. Like nobody ever talks about how that's an option either.
Yeah, like blind weighing or whatever they call it.
Yeah. Where like you can step on backwards. You don't have to look at the number. They don't tell you what the number is. And you tell them not to tell you what the number is. But yeah, those kind of things can be really helpful. If it's just in a letter, especially if it's like signed by a healthcare provider, that can sometimes push it farther. But honestly, it should not have to be. It could be a letter that is done by you that just says, I do not consent to this. And then you don't have to say anything. You don't have to have the conversation in front of everybody else in the waiting room.
Like, that too.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like, I've never even thought to have a letter like that, but it's such a great idea. Mm-hmm. And like, so you just give it to them and say like, hand this to your new provider when you see them, and they just physically hand them a copy of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I love it.
Though I suppose like with a phone call, you could probably just have the letter up on your computer.
Right.
And have it as a script.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Anything to like go in prepared, right? I mean, like, I do that for all doctor's appointments because I will inevitably, even though I work in the healthcare system, I still forget half the questions I was going to ask. So like I go in with lots of prepped things because like my health is complicated and I don't want to miss important things, right? What were the like main interesting findings from your research? Maybe we'll start with the like bad things and then we'll end with the happy things. Cause I always like to end on like a, what can we do and how do we make it better?
Yeah. So I think the kind of like main things was just how pervasive it is. It's just like everywhere. It's within our policies. It's within like all of the procedures that we do. Like it's such a hindrance in some ways because like certain programs won't let you do a referral without a wait, even though the wait is completely like not necessary. And I think that was another piece was like the weight bias within leadership is so hard too, because like one of the things that we would ideally like to get rid of is even just the name obesity. Like what a stigmatizing name, like literally in Latin means to eat oneself fat. Like it's
great.
I think it was in 2016, basically a bunch of people who got together and sat on a board and decided in America whether or not obesity should be a steering committee. That's what it was. Yes.
I'm pretty sure. Yes, I know
what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I do. It was on the maintenance phase podcast too, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Where basically it was like, actually, we don't think that obesity should be a disease because there's no definable symptoms. And it's just going to cause us to overuse different types of medications and surgeries that are unnecessary, which is a strain on the system and also not good for patients either. And so even though they said no, that obesity shouldn't be considered a disease, that they decided to continue with it. And like 75% of people who are of larger size have absolutely no metabolic concerns. Like their cholesterol's fine, everything's fine. Like it's not a good way to decide whether or not somebody's healthy or not. And even if they do have cholesterol problems or blood pressure problems or anything like that, all of those things, they maybe short term have some difference when you do intentional weight loss, but long term they don't.
And those things all exist in people that are thinner.
Thinner, yeah. Size too. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's this idea that it's only in people of larger size. And when you really look at it, like weight stigma and weight cycling play a big role in both of those. Even in diabetes, I think it was 25% more likely if you have weight cycling to have diabetes.
That could be like a correlation versus causation issue though, couldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. But like I think we're just causing a lot more harm.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that example, I can't remember who it was either. They had this big, huge steering committee thing about like, oh, we want to hear from you about weight and how we use obesity or whatever. And like the fact that they just were like, oh no, sorry, that's not what we thought you were going to say, is just such a classic example of what happens in big systems. It happens all the time, right? Yeah. Like we want to hear from you. And then they don't want to hear from you. They just want you to think that they want to hear from you. And they hope that you say the thing that they want to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, kind of side tangent to what I've learned, very side tangent, but a big piece of all of that pervasiveness and it being built into all of these guidelines and the guidelines being built on research that is weight biased itself, of like, we're not even doing research oftentimes on larger size bodies. And then how can we create guidelines for larger size bodies when we don't even do the research on it? Like that's really hard. And then that makes it really hard for like dietitians to change practices, because how do you talk to somebody who's like, yeah, but this guideline from like the American Heart Association or whatever, how do you like go up against that as one tiny dietitian, and this is being quoted back to you as like something that is so such a big important thing that people think is more important than what you have to say, which is so inappropriate because it's based on bad research.
That's what I was going to say is like, yeah, fine. You can say like, but this huge study, and you're like, who funded that study? Could it have been the people who benefit from the diet industry every single day? Like, bet they were involved. They were probably in there somewhere.
Yeah. 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 And then I think the other piece is just like a lack of strong leadership was the big piece that came up as a barrier is just that without the Ministry of Health specifically directing us to stop weight stigma, it's very hard to push through from a grassroots level. Very important because otherwise the ministry is never going to see it as a concern. And I think that's kind of the next piece of what are the things that we can do is like actually speak up about weight stigma. Like even if somebody doesn't really hear you, even if you're like, hey, like, here's my letter. And they're like, oh, that doesn't mean, here's my letter of I don't want to be weighed. And they're like, oh, that doesn't mean anything. That still helps to open the window and provide you a space where you're allowed to consent, because that's what it comes down to is like, even if you, like, you do not have to tell people why weight stigma is so important. Like, that's nice to be like, hey, like, delayed access to care, weight cycling, like harm to health, like disordered eating, like all of these good reasons for why we need to stop telling people to lose weight. But like as a patient or a client, you do not have to say that. You just have to say, I don't consent.
Yeah. And if they try and force your consent, you call Lori.
Exactly.
I will help you figure out who to talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I also think that I did a lot of like looking into like borderline personality disorder stigma reduction and like how mental health stigma reduction is the most evidence-based ways of reducing stigma within mental health care. And like the number one way to do it is like talk to people who have that mental health issue and realize that they're not what you thought they were. Yeah. So like if you have patients that are like various weights, actually, I think it's even more beneficial if it's everybody goes in and says like, I actually don't consent to you talking about my weight. Doesn't matter if I'm skinny or big or whatever. Then they go, oh, like there's people that care about this and are healthy. Like, or there's people that care about this and they are skinny and have all of these health issues. And like, it's just like breaking down that stigma one person at a time that counteracts what they think, right? Like, you know, if you go into a doctor and they only weigh you because you're overweight, quote unquote overweight, and then they also only test you for diabetes and high cholesterol because you're overweight, well, obviously they're going to find more people who have obesity that have diabetes and high cholesterol because those are the only people that they're looking at. Whereas like, I don't know how often people are being tested for diabetes on the smaller end of the spectrum, because it's probably not assumed that they have it, but they totally could. It's like, it's just confirmation bias, really. And so every interaction that you can have where you're trying to like break down that confirmation bias is a stigma reduction initiative, and it's an effective one.
Yeah, totally. I 100% agree. Like the more that you can have these conversations, especially, and I would say in a like safe environment, especially for you to start with, like if you're having these conversations to begin with, maybe starting with like somebody you feel safe with, that's not going to like say anything specifically mean back to you. Because like whenever you get called out on bias, or whenever you're calling somebody else out on their bias, it's always going to be a hard conversation. And feeling safe to do it yourself and making the situation safe for the other person in whatever way you can, of like, maybe not doing it in front of a whole group of people, or like maybe doing it like in a time when they have time to talk to you about it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of was the second piece of like, so important to build relationships and trust first and create a safe environment, and then have an idea of what you want to say before you go into it, so you don't get completely tongue-tied.
Yeah. And I think like being kind to yourself when you aren't mm-hmm. able to have that conversation, because you are so afraid of the healthcare system because of all of the various reasons. Like, you know, most people that listen to this podcast have at least one mental health issue, if not a million of them. And so like, there's so many reasons to fear the system and to feel like your voice doesn't matter or that you can't share your voice. And so if you go and you realize like, I actually can't do this, like, that's okay too. And I think that's where it's really important for everybody to be speaking up about this. Just like, you know, everybody should be speaking up about racism. It doesn't matter if you're the one who's experiencing racism, you should still speak up about it and call people out for it. And I think we're getting a little bit better about that over time. Obviously, we still have a very long way to go in that respect. But you know, when I hear people talk about discrimination in healthcare, I just always add, you know, they give the list of whatever, and I always add like, oh, and like weight stigma, just mm-hmm. so that it's like in people's brains, because people will say like sexism, racism, ableism, or whatever, and then you're just like, well, actually there's this other huge piece that like people are kind of ignoring and that people just get blamed for all the time because it's quote unquote a choice when it's not.
Yeah, it definitely that self-compassion is so important to be able to continue going. And like having somebody who you like can talk to about these conversations, who like understands where you're coming from, of like maybe they're also listening to some podcast about weight stigma, or maybe you like forward them this podcast, or maybe you encourage them to like read or listen to the maintenance phase or the fact doctor or body image with Brie Body Grievers or any of those podcasts. Like, I think that's a great way to start like breaking the ice and have somebody safe to talk to about it, so that when you do have like an awful conversation, you have somebody to debrief with. Totally. That can be so helpful if you have the privilege of being able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many good resources out there. Any book by Aubrey Gordon is shocking. As a person who like mm-hmm. has been overweight my entire life, reading her book, it feels like I'm reading my own diary. Like it's really sad, because you're just like, wow, these experiences are so common that like you could just put my name in this book and it would be the exact same life story. It's wild. And I'm sure like so many people listening to this will be like, yep, and me. So do you have hope for the future of healthcare when it comes to weight stigma?
I do hope. Like the other day, something that gave me hope, and this was also part of my findings, is like, it's so important to see the small wins and like share the small wins so that everybody knows about them. But the other day I was talking to another dietitian, and she does more work on policies, and she was saying that she was putting a policy through for long-term care on height and weight, and when you should be like taking weight in long-term care. And one of the things that came back was it had to go through DEI, which is Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Office. And they actually talked about weight stigma back to her. And I was like, that is amazing.
Whoa. Yeah. That's so cool. I would have not thought that would have been on their radar. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. I had not heard of anything coming through before around weight stigma from them. So I was like so stoked to hear that. So I think that's one of the things, is like when you do have a win, share it. Because hearing those little wins, that's what gives lots of people hope that things can change, and shows that it's not always the same over and over and over again, of like recognizing that, hey, like maybe I talked to like, you know, 25 different people about this, but one of them changed, of like, that's progress. And even if a person doesn't change their mind, like it might take talking to them a lot of times before they even begin to change their mind. And then before they begin to change their practice, but that's their own journey. And all you can do is, as your part, is help them along by providing a space to talk about it and by giving some feedback that, hey, like, have you heard about this?
Yeah. And like, I think, you know, yeah, it might take people the 25 conversations to get somewhere, but that's because it's so ingrained.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, like, I work in like anti-racism, and believe me, people need to have 20 years of unlearning all the things that they've been taught their entire lives when it comes to racism and Indigenous people in Canada and all these things, right? Like, it's, you can't just turn a switch and be like, oh yeah, I guess that was a kind of a stupid opinion, because that's just not how it works. Like, as humans, like, we want to put people in boxes because it makes life easier for us, and it makes it easier for our brains to like process information. So you can't just like change that in a day.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like pulling a thread of like, you might realize that, oh, like, maybe actually in this one situation, it isn't so great. And then you pull it, but, oh, but what about this situation? But what about that situation? And you realize that it's tied to so many other things and so many other beliefs that you had that you have to go through. It takes like a lifetime of unlearning. And that's so important to continue to do also, like, not just getting to a place where like, ah, I know everything, I'm good to go.
Totally. No, the minute you're there, the minute you think that you're there, you're doing it wrong. That's the concept of like cultural humility is the same way. I'm always like, if you think that you're like a culturally safe person who has it all figured out, it means you're not a culturally safe person who has it all figured out, because a culturally safe person who thinks they have it all figured out wouldn't ever think that. It's like a very like weird roundabout way of doing it. So before I ask my final two questions, is there anything that you want to add that we didn't get a chance to talk about? I feel like this hour flew by.
Yeah, definitely flew by. I don't know. I just think this is, first of all, awesome that you brought me on the podcast and that we connected over this, because this is such an important topic to talk about. And I think that kind of one of the easiest ways I found to learn about weight stigma and weight bias on a regular basis is, I don't have like an Instagram account that people follow me on, but I do have like an Instagram account where I have just a bunch of different people who are weight inclusive that I followed. And it's just an easy way to like learn small tidbits every single day about weight stigma to help continue like stretching and learning. And then it's funny how that ends up just stretching and learning all sorts of other things that you didn't really think about before, like maybe ableism or racism or capitalism or sexism and all the intersectionalities that come up with that.
So in terms of my like final questions, what, if you were to give providers, any healthcare provider, like one piece of advice that they should take today to support the movement against weight stigma in healthcare, what would it be?
So if you are thinking about telling somebody to lose weight, I think it's really good to question that. Of like, would a really easy question that you can ask yourself to pick up most weight stigma is, would I tell a thinner person to do the same thing if they had exactly the same problem or exactly the same concerns? Because all of the concerns that happen in larger people also happen in smaller people too. So that's like a really easy way. And that's not to say that healthcare for larger people should be exactly the same as it should be for thinner people. It shouldn't. Like, there should be some things that you know, we actually take into account. Like, for example, doing breast exams. Like, we need to do different breast exams for people of larger size. Like, we need to learn that. Yeah, I think that's probably one of the easiest things to do. And that can be a question that could be thrown back at somebody if you're in like a doctor's office, or if you're in a dietitian office, or if you're in like whatever healthcare office and they tell you to lose weight, or they tell you to do something that involves intentional weight loss, asking, hey, like, what would you tell a person who's thinner?
That's so good.
Yeah, I got that from one of the research studies that I read. So that's not mine, but I will pass it along.
It's so good because, like, even just thinking about, like, that psychiatrist example, had I said, like, had you not asked me what my weight was or if I lied to you about it,
yeah,
would just get more motivation, work out more and eat better be your recommendation for my serious mental health issues? Like, that's, I would have never thought to ask that. I think that's beautiful. And my last question was basically going to be like the same thing about how can patients support this? And I think that's a great example. The like focus on consent and like stand up for yourself when it comes to consent is a good example. Is there another one that you want to throw in there?
Yeah, like the more often that you can stand up for yourself or like stand up for the fact that you have consent, and the more that you talk to other healthcare providers about this, the more that they're going to start to take notice. Because if they get, you know, a couple of patients telling them or asking them like, hey, like, why do you actually need my weight? Or what would you do for a person of thinner size? Like, that helps to start triggering those thoughts. And long term, like what I've seen for the majority of the providers that I've talked to who have changed their mind, it's been those long term conversations where we've talked about a patient over a longer period of time. And, oh, look, like, actually, this didn't work like the thing that you thought it did. Or actually, this thing where we did what we would do for a thinner person did work. And so I think those are really important conversations. And then, of course, the self-compassion and kindness. If you don't feel safe, that's okay. You don't have to have the conversation. If doing a letter feels better to you, then awesome. Like, I think that's a great idea. And I can send you an example letter, Lori, if you'd like.
Yeah, I would love that. And you can also bring people to appointments with you if you feel more comfortable, yes, which people don't recognize very often.
Yeah, and I think that's great too, because oftentimes, I don't know about for you, but for me, it feels the hardest to stand up for myself. Standing up for somebody else feels so much easier.
Totally. If I won the lottery, that's what I would do every day. I would just be like a free mental health advocate that worked with moderate to severe mental health issues. And I would just go to appointments with people and call out providers about being assholes. Like, that would be my number. Like, literally, if I did not have to live and pay for things, that's what I would do. Because people don't have that opportunity. And people, you know, people get so afraid to speak up to providers because they're like, oh, well, they're a doctor. They know everything. Doctors are human too.
Yeah. And especially when it comes to like nutrition and weight, like they don't get very much training around that. Like they are basically steeped in exactly the same diet culture that everybody else is.
Totally. And like that sucks for them too, because I'm sure most of them would not do this, like would not be discriminating or stigmatizing if they could help it, but they just don't have the information. So like we all have to work together for that. It's not just like doctors have all the power, patients have all the power too, they have a lot of power if they use their voice. Thank you so much, Heather. This was so much fun. I love talking about this, and I really hope that you can come back on another day and we can dive into a couple more topics.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Thank you so much for having me, Lori.
Anytime.
Hi, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline, and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.